the land of the rising scrum on Off the Ball.
Yes, you're very welcome to another episode of Land of the Rising Scrum, where we are making our way through the 2019 Rugby World Cup pools, profiling the teams we're set to see later this year in Japan. Today, it's all about the host, Japan, a fixture at every running of this tournament to date. 4 years ago in England, they made their mark on the world and made them stand up and take note when they produced one of the greatest shocks in the tournament history, beating South Africa 34-32 in their opening game, going on to win three of their four matches in the pool stage, but ultimately falling agonising short of a place in the quarterfinals. 4 years on, they'll be opening their home to the world, and we'll provide opposition for Ireland on September 28th, as well as Scotland, Samoa and Russia. And joining me now to speak about Japan is a rugby journalist based over in Japan, Rich Freeman. Rich, good afternoon to you, or a good night to you, based on your timeline.
It is, yeah. Good evening to you. How are you?
I'm not too bad at all. I'm not too bad, Rich. We're still a few months out from the Rugby World Cup, but you're obviously someone who's living over there day to day. Do you get the feeling from the public's view anyway, or from the marketing, or walking around the streets, that there is something happening in a few months' time?
It depends on where you are. In certain places, you can't hide from it now. I mean, on my daily walk, there's a big rugby ball with a countdown clock telling me that's 113 days to go. There's posters around Tokyo, and especially around the host cities, there really is a good feeling that the World Cup is about to hit off. But some of the more remote areas, probably there's still quite a few people that have no idea what's going on.
You're obviously an English journalist based over there. How long have you been over in Japan working the rugby beat?
Doing the rugby beat for about 20 years now. So, yeah, it's been a bit of a while, and it's been, you know, obviously a lot of changes.
And is rugby still very much a kind of a niche sport in Japan? Has it kind of captured the audience so much? I mean, you've the Sunwolves in Super Rugby. Obviously, their Super Rugby run is going to be ended at the end of this. We'll get to that in a few minutes' time. But is there an appetite for rugby in the country?
There is. I mean, it's like a lot of things in Japan. The people who are into a particular sport are absolutely passionate. I mean, and so the hardcore rugby fans are, for them, and this is like a dream come true. They've had Super Rugby. They've got the World Cup coming up. The last World Cup did see an increase in players and in fans, but sadly, over the last 2 or 3 years, that's dropped off again, perhaps because the Japan Rugby Football Union haven't been doing as much as they should. But there is a feeling that obviously, you know, it is a good World Cup. If Japan in particular does perform well, then hopefully it will sort of increase the awareness and the number of people taking part in rugby in Japan.
Yeah, like 4 years ago, Japan, they very much put their stamp on the tournament. Three wins, including that incredible victory in their first game against South Africa. Just narrowly missed out on the quarterfinals. But what was the reaction to that back home in Japan? Like you hinted there, it kind of there was a bit of a bandwagon rolling for a while, and it might have died off. But you know, what was it huge news in Japan, or did we maybe overestimate how big an impact it had?
No, it was massive news. I mean, obviously, I was actually in the UK for 6-7 weeks. So by the time I got back, Japan had obviously had 2 weeks where they'd been back and settled back home after being knocked out. Just to sum it up, I came back and my daughter was in a primary school play. And there were 10 girls on stage doing the Goromaro kicking pose as part of the whole play. Now, in the past, you would never even have thought of rugby being in a schoolgirl play in Japan. You know, you started to see the guys on the television. They were in commercials. And so initially, rugby suddenly became the in thing. As I say, sadly, though, and this is something some of the local Japanese players have talked about, that momentum wasn't sort of carried on by the people in charge here.
Yeah, and why was that? Yeah. Because in the years that followed, we've probably seen a bit of a drop-off. Eddie Jones would have left and gone to England. But results-wise, over the last couple of years, there have been a few signs of Japan staying up around that level. They got a draw against France, beat Italy in the last year or so. And on their tour of the Northern Hemisphere about 6-7 months ago, ran England very close in the first half, were excellent in that. Ultimately, England's depth just kind of showed over the course of the 80 minutes. But it was a... they have shown they're capable of putting it up to the bigger teams.
Oh, yeah, definitely. On the field, things have obviously improved. A lot of that has, you talk to people like Michael Leach and some of the top Japanese players like Tanaka, they'll say that that's because of their involvement in Super Rugby. That's allowed them to maintain that high level that they obviously achieved in 2015. Off the field, there are some problems, rather like maybe some other unions overseas. It's run by some rather elderly gentlemen in blazers who perhaps aren't quite with it in terms of professional sport. And that's obviously been a slight problem here, because the Sunwolves have embraced a new breed of fans, but that's not often seen at the sort of the top league corporate level. And that's one of the issues that Japan will have to face post-World Cup.
From the squad itself, how much has that changed over the last couple of years? Jamie Joseph is the new coach now. Do they still play pretty much along the same stylistic ways as we would have seen 4 years ago, or have they kind of tweaked things around with a new coaching ticket?
They've tweaked things around a little bit. I mean, Tony Brown, who is Jamie Joseph's assistant, is very much a believer in the kicking game in terms of getting field position. So they have kicked probably more than they would have done under Eddie Jones. But you are still going to see that fast, high-paced brand of rugby, because obviously that's the style that suits the Japanese players, particularly the backs. They will look to utilize space. They will look to go on the outside and play an attacking brand of rugby that obviously delights fans around the world.
And what are the chances that they can put in a repeat performance of last time around? The pool itself, Ireland, Scotland, Russia, Samoa and Japan. What do you think is the realistic target for Japan? Is it to get to a quarter final? I know they've Scotland in the last game of the pool. If they can go in there with a fighting chance, really, is that all they can ask for?
I think so. I mean, when the draw was made, people were sitting there and going, oh, well, it's a pretty good draw. But you look at Scotland, and you know, I was actually talking to Stuart Hogg the other day about this on the phone, and I said, well, you know, obviously a lot will depend on, is it the Scotland that played that second half against England, or is it the Scotland that lost to America last year? That is the game I think they're going to have to target. Ireland were out here a few years ago without their British and Irish Lions and were far too strong for Japan. You can't write off Samoa. I mean, at the last World Cup, Japan did very, very well against Samoa in their pool game, but traditionally the Samoan power has always caused problems for Japan. So it is a tough group, but obviously the nation are hoping, and you know, Jamie Joseph has said this is what he's employed to do, is to get them into that last eight.
And before I leave you go as well, a quick word on the Sunwolves in Super Rugby. A couple of months ago, we would have learned the news that their time in Super Rugby was coming to an end. Sanzar weren't going to be retaining them for next year's tournament. What happens for them next year? What happens to all those players contracted to them? Have they a future signing into a different league? Or ultimately, is the Sunwolves franchise itself going to be disbanded? And what impact does that further on have for Japanese rugby as a whole?
That's a very good question. As far as the players are concerned, most of them play for top league sides over here, and the top league is running from January to May as of next season. It's a massive change in the whole system and the way that Japanese rugby is run. So for the players themselves, they will be contracted to top league teams playing in the Japan domestic competition. That obviously leaves a massive problem, because the Sunwolves still have one season to run. And the news today was that Tony Brown is going back to the Highlanders to be an assistant coach. So that means the Sunwolves will be looking for their fifth coach in 5 years. There's talk about bringing in some Northern Hemisphere players. We've just had an Irish player signed 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. So there is a possibility that some Northern Hemisphere players will be playing some Super Rugby next year just to get the experience. The team want to carry on. What they've done amazingly is build up a fan base, because in Japan rugby, it's run by the corporations. And so for a lot of fans, it's hard to feel any sort of affinity or closeness to Toshiba or Panasonic. I mean, people joke that they support Suntory because they like the beer, or they support Panasonic because they have a refrigerator in their kitchen. The Sunwolves is a team that people, true rugby fans, really believe in. And so the team want to carry on. It's a question of how they can and what tournament they can possibly find to play in.
Okay, Rich, thanks a million for taking your time out of a busy evening, I'm sure, to speak to us. And hopefully we'll catch up again soon, closer to the World Cup.
Yep, no problems at all.
Yeah, that was Rich Freeman there talking to us about the current Japan side, who are getting ready to host the Rugby World Cup in the next couple of months. And joining me next on Land of the Rising Scrum, I'm absolutely delighted to say, is the hero from that famous Japan win against South Africa in 2015. Carne Hesketh, scorer of the try, with the clock in the red to make it 34-32 to Japan and seal the most famous result, I think, in the history of the Rugby World Cup. Carne, good evening and good afternoon, and thank you for joining us. Yours is a story, I think, when we started this series recently enough, looking at all the teams across the World Cup. It's one of these stories we just wanted to hear about. I'm delighted you've joined us. Does it ever get boring to hear about that try, or to look back on that try, or talk about that try again?
I don't think it could ever get boring looking back on it. It was such a special occasion. You know, at the time, obviously at the World Cup, you had to focus on the next game and things like that. But reflecting on it after and in hindsight, it was an amazing feat, and it was an amazing thing for rugby in general, I think.
It's almost 4 years ago now since it, obviously, with the World Cup coming around. Does it feel like that, or does it feel like, you know, it's really just passed you in the last year or so?
It really has gone so quickly. I think probably for about 2 years after we got back from the World Cup, just things were just so crazy in Japan rugby-wise, and then building up to the next World Cup. So it just feels like it's been one big World Cup sort of thing.
How did life itself change for you when you got home? Did it feel different in particular to when you went out? And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people probably hadn't given you too much of a chance of causing an upset at the World Cup. But despite the fact that you didn't get to a quarterfinal, three wins in the pool that contains South Africa, Samoa and Scotland is a pretty incredible achievement.
It is. Mainly things that changed was just the media, the involvement of people trying to get into rugby, just the general interest in rugby, also the surprise of us beating South Africa, and also not making the playoffs as well, which was disappointing. But rugby just started booming after that, and it was good for Japan rugby.
Before I talk about the match itself, I might just go back to your own story, and obviously you're New Zealand born. How did you end up in Japan, and how long were you over there before you wore a Brave Blossoms jersey?
So I started playing my footy in NZ, and I went to Otago University and played a little bit of footy there, and I just wanted to look around and play some ITM Cup somewhere in New Zealand, and just by luck, they came back with this sort of an offer to play 1 year in Japan, and I thought, oh yeah, I'll give it a go. Then I went 1 year, and then 2 years, and two more years, and then I think by my fourth year, I was looking at trying to aim to make the Japan squad by then, yeah.
And coming into the World Cup, like, you had been around for, I think, was it about a year or so before the World Cup itself? You know, you were part of... You were on the bench on the day as well. What did that feel like, watching the game from the sidelines?
Funnily enough, I've been a bench player even at my club side. You know, because in Japan we've got the foreigner rule. You can only play so many foreigners. I come off the bench majority of my games, so I do kind of get to watch a lot of the first half and try and figure out how things are going and where I can make a sort of a difference when I come on. Watching that game, it was nerve-wracking. That was just, you know, everything happening at pinpoint precision for us anyway. Everything was going right, and I was really nervous to get on, actually.
And the game itself, I was watching it back last night. It actually just was a bizarre game. I know it's a cliche, but it essentially just was like Japan hadn't read the script, because on six different occasions, South Africa actually went ahead of you, and each time, I remember watching it at home, I would have been thinking, okay, this is, you know, with this try, this is going to be the moment where they actually pull clear and go ahead and, you know, see off Japan. And on each occasion, you just got back into it, whether it was a penalty from Garamaru or whether it was a try, and all of a sudden it got down to the last few minutes. Like, there must have just been an incredible level of self-belief in the team to stick with a team like South Africa throughout those 80 minutes and constantly know that at some stage we are going to have a chance to get back into this. It's not over yet.
Well, I suppose, you know, Eddie Jones is a mastermind of World Cup rugby. So our whole campaign leading up to that World Cup was to beat the Springboks and train at a level where we instilled the belief that we could beat them as well. So, you know, we were always within the range of them anyway, whether they were one try ahead or whatever, we still weren't far off, so we still had belief. And that was just a result of training with the mindset for probably close to seven months, I suppose.
You mentioned Eddie Jones there. He's obviously a figure that ourselves in Ireland have become very familiar with over the last few years since he took charge of England. What sort of a character is he like to have as your own head coach? He doesn't seem to necessarily ever be too popular with opponents. He's always very quick to rile them up. He loves playing the bit of mind games and throwing a little verbal hand grenade into the mix there. What's he like to have in your corner backing you up?
Well, when there's no one around and it's a team training, he's a tough bugger. he's hard to please. But, you know, training's training. Footy's footy. When it's time to switch off, he's a lovely guy. He's a great guy to talk to. You know, he's quite a worldly, experienced man and just a normal guy, I suppose.
And coming into the tournament, had he instilled this belief in you that you were as good as anyone, you were well within your rights to challenge in any single game that you played?
Oh, definitely, 100%. Every single member.
On the game itself, you actually came on late on in that match. What was the message? I think, was it 78, 79 minutes you came onto the pitch, you were pushing for the try line. Was there a particular message, like essentially just, Karen, get on there, get us a try?
To be honest, I can't really remember exactly. But I was actually down there waiting to get on about 73 minutes. But play just kept going on and on and on in penalties, and we weren't allowed to make substitutions until, I think, yeah, it was around the 77 mark. But it was just to get on and add something, whatever you can add. And I think I actually switched from the right wing to the left wing at one point to try and take a left-hand scrum. So I was just trying to get involved. There was only 3 minutes left, and it worked out.
Yeah, and as the clock is kind of heading towards the red, went to the TMO, the try wasn't given, it came back for a scrum, and you got a penalty off the resulting scrum. It would have been a very kickable penalty. It was only a three-point game. At any stage, were you thinking in your head, put these over the posts, let's take a draw, or was it just 100% it's win or bust in this situation?
I honestly had no thoughts at that time. I would have hate to be the guy to make that decision as well. But I mean, considering we're a Japanese side, a draw or a win would have been a win either way, but a win would have been the better outcome. So I think that we went for the more courageous sort of option.
Yeah, I suppose like there are only so many times in your career you're going to be within 3 points of the Springboks, piling on pressure when the clock is in the red, last play of the game. You may as well just completely go for it, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, well, if we had missed the try and lost by three, I don't think anyone would have faulted us for that. They would have still thought it was a great game to watch.
The moment itself then, the scrum, it kind of, ball goes out towards the right, your captain Michael Leach looked like he might have been getting close at one stage, and all of a sudden then that kind of creates this overlap out on the left wing where you're standing there waiting patiently, I imagine. Are you screaming for the ball? Are you, you know, just screaming in your head because you don't want to alert too many defenders to the fact that there's a big overlap out there and there's space to work with?
I'm just waiting patiently. I would have to give credit to Muffy, who actually put a very good handoff in and a wonderful pass. So it might have been quite an overlap that without that play. And also, I think I got a bit lucky with JP Peterson as well. He's a big, strong man, and I was almost out on the touchline as well.
Yeah, even I was watching and I look at the tackle and he kind of comes in a little bit high, and you can even see the moment where you're jutting your head almost to the left-hand side, trying to eke out every little last centimetre you can possibly get for yourself. You get over the line, you touch the ball down, you dive over, and it's just absolute bedlam or carnage, as I think your Skype handle and your username, your YouTube name has gone with. I even saw in the background, like the paramedics, the ambulance crew standing behind the advertising boards, are jumping up and down, celebrating at the fact that you've gone over and scored this try. What was that feeling like?
It was incredible. Like the atmosphere. I suppose the biggest thing was the atmosphere. It was just energetic and loud. You couldn't hear anything, and you just had a feeling of pride and something great had happened, I suppose. Yeah.
And like, was there a chance for celebrations? Because I remember at the time there was a lot of talk about how it was incredibly unfair. There were a lot of tier two nations who had to play, you know, two games in the space of 4 days, and you were one of them. You were back on the pitch just a few short days later. Did you let loose and celebrate, or were you holding it back ever so slightly because there was a game just around the corner?
That's one game I would have loved to have a 2 week turnaround because we did not have time to celebrate. We had a couple of beers with dinner together as a team and celebrated kind of like that, but we didn't really get to have a good old beer and a late night. So we had we kind of had a light training the next day as well.
On the flip side then, having a game so close, did it just kind of keep the momentum on your side, really? Because there was this, you know, this huge wave of momentum after a win against South Africa, and all of a sudden you started going back. You won the following day as well, if I remember correctly, and from there it was just narrowly missed out. That game against Scotland ultimately was the one that got away.
Well, was it a 4 day turnaround or a 5 day turnaround? I can't remember.
It was Saturday. I think it was 19th to 23rd. I think it was just 4 days.
Yeah. So you know, like it's real tough. We played a good 50 minutes, but it's just too tough at that level to turn around and play a top quality side like Scotland. Had we had a week turnaround, maybe we would have done better. Maybe who knows? But that's just the way it goes. It's the tournament, and you know, you got to play with the hands you're dealt.
And ultimately, you didn't qualify. But looking back, I mean, there wasn't really much more you could have done. I imagine those few weeks over in England for the World Cup probably the proudest you'll ever have on a rugby pitch.
Oh, definitely. And the support was amazing. It just felt like Japan became everyone's second team, sort of thing, and. Oh yeah, it was just such a lovely, lovely tournament to be involved in. The crowds, the people, you know, because we walk around, we go to the shops in our team kit, and you get people like just saying hi and well done and things like that. It was just so wonderful.
And you're still based in Japan, obviously, at the moment. You haven't played for Japan in a few years' time. Are you retired from international rugby, or is it just something there where you haven't been, you know, you just haven't been essentially selected for a couple of years now? Or would you still have a hope maybe of getting back in someday?
Nah, I'm a bit too old for that now, I think. I'm just playing club rugby over here now and doing the family thing, doing a lot of sort of World Cup rugby hype and, you know, that kind of thing for this year anyway. And, yeah, that's about it for now. International rugby is done, and just supporting.
And I'm sure over the next few months you're going to be talking to a lot more people about 2015 and about that try as well. Are you ready to look back over us? I'm sure about hundreds of times between now and the start of the World Cup.
Oh yeah, I've been practicing for four years now, so it should be pretty smooth.
You may as well live off it. It's a once-in-a-lifetime chance. Also, as well, I have to ask, in my research, I came across the YouTube channel. You have to resurrect that as well. For those who haven't seen it, it's Carnage 14. Some of those videos are a few years old, but there's plenty of entertainment in them. Is that just what a young rugby player, kind of when you're bored, there's not a lot to do, mess around and make a few videos?
Oh, man, I was a bit younger then. I had a lot of time on my hands. I've got a young family now, so maybe when they're a bit older, I might start back in there. It sure was fun work, especially the rugby stuff. So that might be on the cards later on, I suppose.
Well, for anyone who hasn't seen it, I highly recommend it. Some very interesting videos there. Karen, thanks a million for taking the call with us this morning, and I'm sure we'll hear again from you between now and the start of the World Cup.
You're welcome.
Yeah, that was Karen Hesketh, hero of Japan's win against South Africa in 2015, speaking to us there. Just a reminder, our rugby coverage on Off the Ball is brought to you by Vodafone, team of us, everyone in. That's it for Land of the Rising Scrum next week. We'll speak to you again soon.
The Land of the Rising Scrum on Off the Ball.